This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Christine Vachon, is a prominent producer of independent films. Her company, Killer Films, made I Shot Andy Warhol, Happiness, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, Boys Don't Cry, One Hour Photo, Far From Heaven, The Company, The Notorious Betty Page, and Infamous. She's worked with directors ranging from John Waters to Robert Altman. Her new memoir is called A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. She says the independent film world has changed a lot since she started making movies in the early 90s. I asked her if the success of the 1994 film Pulp Fiction was behind some of those changes.
In the early 90s, when we were releasing movies, by Todd Haynes and Tom Kalin and Rose Troche, etc., you know, $1 million gross was a celebration. A $2 million gross was opening champagne. A $3 million gross, I mean, those films hit a lot of singles and doubles, you know, and that was great. They were profitable. They were made for the right amount of money. And then Pulp Fiction came along and made like $50 million. And that kind of changed everything. It was like, well, then, you know, the companies that had been very happy with their singles and doubles wanted those big, fat home runs. So our independent films started being looked at with a little bit more scrutiny of whether, you know, could it cross over? Could it be a huge hit? Also, stars started to become more important because, you know, when I first started out, nobody cared if a movie was small. Nobody cared who was in it so much. It was kind of the fun of making a small movie was the pressure of cast wasn't a big deal. But now it's very rare, I think, even on so-called tiny movies, that there isn't pressure to come up with a star who will, you know, guarantee that somebody pulls it off the, you know, the shelf at the video DVD store.
Let me ask you a question. When you're a producer, are you often in the position of being the bad guy because as the producer you're saying, no, you have to cut the scene, it's too expensive, you can't do that shot, it's too expensive, you can't hire this actor, she's too expensive?
No, I'm not really, that's not really me. I'm more like trying to figure out, I guess what a great producer does is try and support the film in the best way possible. And usually what that means is helping the director figure out how to make it work within the means that we have. And if the director is absolutely convinced that there's something that will call, you know, that is beyond our means, that is absolutely essential to the film working, whether it's an actor or a location or, you know, a more expensive costume, whatever it is, then part of my job is to try and figure out how to get it for him or her, you know, whether it's taking money from somewhere else, trying to convince the financiers that it's worth it, whatever it is. I mean, ultimately, my loyalty has to be to the vision of the film. Not that I don't have arguments. I mean, there's certainly times when a director feels that something's essential and I feel like it's, you know, that there's other things that are more essential and we'll certainly discuss it. But, you know, that's really what I do. I'm not so much the bad guy as, you know, the diplomat.
Now, one of your latest movies is called Infamous, and it's a movie about Truman Capote and his relationship with one of the two murderers that he writes about in Cold Blood. And this was the second of the two Truman Capote movies to be released. After you had agreed to make Infamous, you found out that another Truman Capote movie was in the works, the one that starred Philip Seymour Hoffman. So
right.
What was your reaction when you found out, and what did you want to do to counter it?
Everything kind of happened bit by bit. I mean, when we found out about the other script, we were both, you know, their project and our project were both kind of in the same place. We were both trying to get our financing together. I mean, look, honestly, I wish that, you know, they hadn't existed. But they did, and what's really amazing to me is, you know, Warner's let us make our movie anyway. But it's, you know, look, it's a difficult situation because what I really wanted to have happen once it was clear that, you know, it's like they got their money, they started shooting a month or two later, we got our money, we started shooting, you know, they were finishing, we were finishing. You know, it was a little bit of a race. And then we dropped out of the race. Warner Independent decided to wait and release the film the following year, really to give Infamous, you know, a chance to sort of live and breathe on its own. But I really feel, and I made as strong a case as I could for this, that we should have gone out at the same time. But, you know, who knows what would have happened? We'll never know. And the great thing about, you know, these days, films do have a much longer life on because of DVD, and I just hope people get to see our film.
One of the movies that your company made was Party Monster. And you say that this movie was particularly hard to finance, and it almost went straight to video. Why did it almost go straight to video, and what are the consequences of having that happen?
Well, you know, I was surprised, and I continue to be surprised that Party Monster was as difficult to finance as it was. But I think ultimately it was because it was a very unsympathetic character, and who I think was played wonderfully by Macaulay Culkin. And James St. James, you know, was played beautifully by Seth Green. The film went to Sundance. It had a mixed reception. The reviews were definitely, you know, they were definitely negative to mixed with some positive. But to me, I always felt like, you know what, a theatrical distributor just has to take this out on the, you know, there's so much curiosity on what, you know, what Macaulay is doing now, and it's such a bravura performance. I just thought it was a no-brainer. But, you know, we were working with a company called Content Film, and an offer was made, you know, from a straight-to-video company that was substantially higher than the offers we were getting from from theatrical companies. And it had a really severe effect. I mean, you know, we'd made our record deal, promising the record company that we would have a theatrical distribution. So it was things like that. But it was also an emotional thing. You know, I really felt like we had – this was a big deal for Macaulay. I mean, it was his first movie in years. It was a very brave performance.
Well, he plays a club kid who gets so addled by drugs and is so self-absorbed and selfish, he ends up becoming a murderer. And mm-hmm. it's a really great performance.
Well, I just felt like I owed it to him to protect not just the experience, which I felt that we did. I think he had a wonderful experience actually filming the movie. But I felt like we owed it to him to protect the experience of the film coming out. And for it to go straight to video after, you know, after all the hard work that we had all done, but especially for him in terms of his, you know, beginning his career again as an actor, it was devastating. Luckily, Strand Releasing, a company run by Marcus Hu, which is a distribution company that frequently distributes foreign films, art films, edgy films, they were very anxious to take it out theatrically, and they did quite a good job, even though they didn't have that much money to spend on it.
One of the things, of course, that you have to deal with is ratings. And filmmakers don't like to get NC-17s because it limits the number of theaters you can be shown in and limits the advertising you can
even
do.
An NC-17 is basically cutting you off at the financial knees.
Mm-hmm. Your stores won't distribute, some chains won't distribute DVDs mm-hmm. of these films. So because your films often deal not only with sexual relationships, but sometimes with gay sexual relationships, these ratings are do you feel like you're more likely to get NC-17 ratings when you're making a film that is dark or when you're making a film that has gay content, gay sexual content?
Well, I mean, we've had four big ratings battles. Swoon, which really surprised me because there's virtually no graphic sex in the film whatsoever. And in fact, a lot of people's complaint about the movie was there's no graphic sex in it whatsoever. So getting an NC-17 and the other thing, Swoon came out around the same time as Basic Instinct, which got an R. And it was kind of incredible to see that, you know, Swoon, which was, you know, chaste, you know, getting hit with an NC-17, and then, you know, you watch Basic Instinct and just watch, you know, the blinking vagina. So it was a real example to me of like the sort of hypocrisy of the system.
So you felt that the film got an unfairly severe rating?
I did, yes.
What's an example of a movie where you negotiated with the ratings board and ended up changing a scene to avoid an NC-17?
Boys Don't Cry.
What did you have to change?
Well, I mean, first of all, the ratings board is very clear that you do not negotiate with them, that they are not a censorship organization, that they're simply there to rate films, and that whatever happens once the film leaves the auspices of the MPAA, i.e. theaters won't show it or newspapers won't advertise it, that's not their problem. You know, they're there to rate the film. But with Boys Don't Cry, I feel like they had a little bit of a – there was a little bit of perhaps, you know, in the inner workings of the MPAA, I think there was some conflict because they do understand. They did understand that giving the film an NC-17 – was going to basically, you know, condemn it to, you know, a tiny number of theaters. And I think there were people there who felt that the film deserved more than that. So we ended up, it ended up being really about the rape scene and the violence of that and how long it went on. So we ended up trimming that scene in order to get an R.
And this is the scene in which the main character who is a girl passing as a boy because she feels like she really is more of a boy, mm-hmm. Is discovered and raped by the guys who are just repulsed by the whole idea of her trying to pass as a boy.
That's right.
So what did you cut? And do you think it really affected the movie?
I mean, I don't. I think I'm not sure if Kim Pierce, the director, would agree with me. And actually I'd be really curious to revisit her thoughts on that. I think that would be really interesting, you know, years down the line. Does she feel that it had a real, creative impact on, you know, the effect of seeing the film? I don't know. I don't think it did. I think that, you know, the compromise in trimming that scene, you know, not substantially, because we did not take a whole lot of it out, the fact that meant that it could go out as widely as it did, I mean, it was a compromise worth making.
Now, one of the things that you do as a producer, I assume, is negotiate song rights if you want to use a song in a movie.
Yes. I mean, my music supervisor usually does that. And
they don't come
to me unless there's, like, some huge problem.
But you have to deal with the fact that money has to be set aside for this.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Is that a big part of a budget? You know, if you want to use, like, known recordings in your movie?
Well, I mean, most music supervisors would say it's not nearly a big enough part of a budget. But, yes, it is a big part of our budget. Often it's the place where a director can say that he or she will compromise when we're going into production. But then when reality kind of sets in the editing process, their eyes get a lot bigger, you know, than their stomachs. And, you know, directors start to believe that, you know, that really the only way a scene will work is with, you know, this song over it. And it is hard because there are some songs that are simply impossible. We were so committed in Boys Don't Cry in the opening scene when Brandon's at the skating rink to a song by Boston, More Than a Feeling, that completely summed up the sort of teenage longing that was happening right there in that skating rink. But the song was like $500,000. So we didn't use it.
And what'd you get instead?
We got the Cars song, Just What I Needed.
And was it as effective, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, for us, initially, watching it, all we could hear was the fact that that fantastic Boston song wasn't there anymore. But, you know, for an audience coming in and seeing the movie for the first time, I think the Cars song had just that same element of, you know, teenage desire that Boston had.
Now, you're a mother. You have a 7 or 8 year old child.
7 year old.
Yeah. So, did being a mother change your sensibility at all? You know, because a lot of the complaints about edgy films and films that are, you know, like transgressive in any way, is that it creates a bad climate for children. And of course, children wouldn't be allowed to see most of your movies anyways. But I think a lot of parents get very protective of their children's sensibility and anything that might offend it. Suddenly, anything that might offend children or be wrong for children can become offensive to parents as well. So I'm just wondering if it changed your sensibility at all to have to become a mother.
Well, you know, I got to say, I remember when we were trying to get Happiness financed, an executive said to me, I can't finance this film, and if you were a parent, you would understand why I couldn't.
I'm going to interrupt you right here and say that one of the characters, this really kind of affable character, turns out to be a pedophile in the movie. So go ahead.
Well, I was really struck by that, and a few years later, when I did become a parent, I sort of re-examined myself, okay, would I have not done Happiness now? And I was like, no way, of course I would do it. Like, that's ridiculous. I just feel like, I mean, I'd almost rather have my daughter watch, not all, but some of my, I'd rather have her watch certain of my films than watch commercial television any day. That offends my sensibility a lot more. And, you know, there is, I mean, there are movies that children aren't supposed to see. You know, I understand, I don't love seeing movies where terrible things are done to children, but I didn't like seeing them before I was a parent either. You know, so I just think it's changed my sensibility in that I'd love to make a great kids film. I mean, I've been dragged off to, you know, you name it.
What children's movies did you love to see as a child?
Well, as a child, I'm trying to remember. I mean, we, you know, I think the first movie I ever saw, which also I think for a lot of people my age was the first movie they ever saw, was Mary Poppins.
Mm-hmm.
But my older sister, when I was about 8, Oliver came out, and I was obsessed with seeing Oliver because, you know, we had the soundtrack, and I couldn't wait to see it. So my older sister, you know, was dispatched by my parents to take me to see Oliver, and she took me to 2001 instead.
The songs are great in 2001.
So it was a very different experience, and I was a little like, oh, my God. But it had a huge effect on me. And then I think the following week she was supposed to take me to see Oliver again, and this time she took me to see Alice's Restaurant. and also, you know, in those days there weren't quite so many. I think there just weren't so many films for kids. And if your parents wanted to take you to the movies, they had to sort of see. I mean, my parents went to see Blazing Saddles.
Mm-hmm.
And then came back from seeing it saying, oh, we have to take the kids to this. And took, you know, we were probably about 8 or 9 years old, me and my brother, and off we went to see Blazing Saddles. And wanted to show it to my daughter recently, but my girlfriend and I looked at it first, and we were a little like, wow, this is really profane. And I'm not sure she's ready for it.
Well, she's too young for the Cole Porter jokes, too.
Right. Yes. And the Hedy Lamarr and all of that.
Your father was a photographer, and he worked during the WPA era in the mid-1930s. He worked for the Farm Security Administration, taking pictures of government relief efforts to show that they were actually helping.
Well, what the FSA's mission was to document the Depression. So sometimes it was of the relief efforts, but it was also just like, you know, these are the farms, these are the people, this is the poverty, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And this is the same group of photographers that Walker Evans was part of.
Walker Evans, Gordon Parks was one, Ben Shawn, Dorothea Lange.
Mm-hmm. And then your father worked for Look magazine, and he took pictures of, among other people, President Kennedy, Marilyn Monroe, Judy Garland. So did all these photos have an impact on you growing up? Did it say to you when you were growing up, visual images have real value. They are important.
I guess looking back on it, that seems like a conclusion one could draw. I don't really remember feeling that per se. In some ways, I feel like the fact that I could walk to the movie theater and, you know, just go in and see whatever was playing at the Thalia or, you know, the Olympia, which were all theaters in my neighborhood, You know, the experience of watching movies was, you know, such a big part of my childhood, and watching them, you know, in the dark. But, you know, I guess the fact that the photographs he took, they were around the house. They were clearly, you know, extremely vivid, you know, representations of the world at that time. And they must have had an effect.
How old were you when you were able to go to the movies by yourself?
8 or 9. I mean, it was literally down the street.
That's really young.
Well, you know, yeah, it was
young in the sense that would be considered too young, I think, for a lot of parents to allow their children to take the bus or the train or walk a few blocks away from home just because so many streets are unsafe.
Well, it was a different time, although I would argue that New York of the 70s was far more dangerous than it is now. And, you know, we would often go to the theater. Our local theater was called the Olympia. It was on 106th Street and Broadway. You know, it's the kind of theater where your feet would stick to the floor. Mm-hmm. And we would often get an adult to walk us into the, you know, R-rated or PG-13 films. And people would willingly do it.
So what were you exposed to as a child that probably many adults would think was horrible for you to be exposed to?
Honestly, one of the most, and I think I talk about this in the book, but when I was about 10, a friend of mine and I walked down to Times Square, and, you know, Times Square was filled with movie theaters at that time. A lot of them were porno theaters, but a lot of them weren't. And we decided that we wanted to go see a horror film. So we looked at all the titles because we had no other way of telling if a movie was a horror film than by what it was called. You know, we didn't read reviews. We just looked at the marquees, and one of the theaters was showing a film called Cries and Whispers. We thought, well, that must be a horror film. So in we went, and it certainly was a horror film, but not in the way we had thought. And it was a stunning experience. I mean, I don't know when was the last time you saw that film, but it is not for a 10-year-old. I mean, it's a devastating, depressing, graphic film, but a wonderful film. And we both walked out of there a little like, oh, my God. Like, I didn't know films could do that.
Did that have a big impact on you, this
film? Oh, yeah. It had a huge impact on me. But then again, so did going to see Wizard of Oz in the theater, you know, which I'd watched, you know, every year on our small black and white television, and seeing that it was, you know, that half of it was actually in color.
You know, our listeners might know that Ira Glass's public radio program, This American Life, now has a TV version that will premiere sometime in the near future on Showtime. And your company is producing, if I have that straight, is producing...
We're executive producing.
Executive producing. Whatever that means. I never know what a title means anymore. But you're executive producing the series. How did you get matched up with Ira?
Well, I went to college with Ira.
No, we were I didn't know that.
Yeah, we were really good friends for a while, and we really lost touch after college. So, so when we... I can't remember exactly the circumstances, like, did his agent call us or did we call his agent or how? I just don't remember how it all went down. But apparently there had been some attempts to turn This American Life to television before, and I think Ira had felt burned before. And we just started, you know, we started a development process, you know, quite a few years ago now. You know, it's really Ira's show. And it's really wonderful. I'm very excited about it, and I'm really excited to see how people react.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the series. Christine Vachon, thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Christine Vachon is the president of the independent film production company Killer Films and the author of the new memoir, A Killer Life. The company has several films in production now, including Savage Grace, starring Julianne Moore, Then She Found Me, directed by Helen Hunt, and I'm Not There, a film about Bob Dylan, directed by Todd Haynes.